Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. And as usual, I didn't realize the day was Easter Sunday until probably yesterday. That's what happens when you live in a hole or a cave and you pull the lid over. I really didn't remember. But anyway, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. Our guest is Dr. Deborah Duncan Owens, and we're talking about her incredible book called The Origins of the Common Core, How the Free Market Became Public Education Policy. And we're going to just launch right into it because we have so much to cover today. Deborah, welcome back.
Hello. Thank you. Good to talk to you again, James.
Thank you, and happy holiday.
Yes, happy Easter and happy Passover.
I'm kind of notorious for not knowing one day from the next, because when you live in a hole, every day seems to be like every other day. So, now, do you remember where we left off last time?
I certainly do.
We had covered a lot. That's all foundational, preparing us for the real meat of your story in the middle of your book and going to the end. So let us pick up. Well, let us give a little summary. One of the things that shocked us at the very end of the show was the discovery of there was a study that refuted the now infamous A Nation at Risk. And we had either a caller and a PM from a person saying that not only were they aware of that study, they had a copy of it. And
yes,
that person sent both of us copies of this famous study. You want to give us a little brief intro about the study, and then the caller is waiting to come in. We're going to open up with him for just a few minutes before we get back on track to finish off where we left off from last time.
Sure. We concluded our talk last week by discussing the Sandia Report, which was actually commissioned by the first Bush administration. I think they were hoping that they would get confirmation of A Nation at Risk, but they got something quite different. And picking up on that information was a fellow scholar out there and a teacher activist, and I would like to hear from him.
Our caller is Joe Nashville, and if you guys remember, he did come on last week, and I invited him to come back once he sent us the report, and he just sent me a PM saying that he was ready and he was holding online. So I'm hoping that was true and he will be able to come in any second now.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, while we're waiting, I'd like to take a couple of minutes, and you can interrupt me when you get the caller, and talk a little bit about the metaphor of the Common Core State Standards as the gorilla in the room. That's actually the title, or part of the title, of Chapter 9 in my book. And I gave a lot of thought to what it is about the Common Core State Standards that has caused such a firestorm across the nation. It became the face of education reform. And we can thank President Obama and Arne Duncan for actually inviting this gorilla in the room. So for me, it's a metaphor. I'll explain it. First of all, I'm not disparaging gorillas. They're lovely animals, but they have a huge commanding presence, and I think that's why it's an apt metaphor. And absolutely, if you have a gorilla sitting in the middle of a room, you're going to like look at the gorilla and wait to see what happens. But I want everyone to sort of visualize this big gorilla sitting in a lovely room surrounded by people. And in the hand of the gorilla is a set of standards. You see, because the gorilla, if the common core is the gorilla in the room, the gorilla in the common core really has no power unless it has all of these things attached to it. And so envision the gorilla, and in his hands, he's holding a huge set of tests, standardized tests, and it's the tests that actually give the gorilla purpose. He'd be rather benign. This Common Core state standards might be rather benign if it weren't for the fact that the gorilla brings with it all these tests with it. Now, the tests are significant because the Common Core is a set of standards, and we know that the federal government is absolutely forbidden from dictating, influencing anything to do with the curriculum in our country. But if the gorilla has in its hands a huge stack of standardized tests that are directly related to those standards, then in fact, what that gorilla represents is a national curriculum. Because whether we like it or not, teachers, if you know your livelihood is dependent on test scores, you will teach to the standards. As a matter of fact, and I think it was 2007, I was at an education research conference. And Roy Romer, who is notoriously linked to the Common Core state standards through the National Governors Association, was speaking to a huge audience about public policy, public education policy. And one of the people in the audience, when it came time for questions, which they try to not to have too much time for questions, but somebody raised their hand and asked the inevitable question. With all the standardized testing, aren't you at the federal level and with national policy, aren't you concerned about teachers teaching to the test? And here's what he said. He said, "What's wrong with teaching to a well-designed test?" He said, "I think that's absolutely the correct thing to do." So that was in 2007, maybe 2008. And so that's what if you envision this gorilla, he's got all these tests in his hands. Now, let's take it a step further, because even that, those are two points that are problematic. But let's add to that. Poised on top of these big standardized tests are a couple of other things that this gorilla is holding in his hands. One is a set of computer programs that are designed to mine data from the tests. Now, that was like a wellspring, that whole concept, when it was included in, data mining was included in Race to the Top policies, because that opened the door for all kinds of entrepreneurs and data programs to not only develop the data, but also to develop ways to market it. And then on top of those computer programs, you have another set of regulations and value-added models for holding teachers accountable for test scores. And those two things sitting on top of the test now, in the gorilla's hands, are actually very masterful when you consider the corporate takeover of public schools, because those things in and of themselves have a way, a masterful way for helping to break the unions and to get rid of a whole lot of teachers. And so that brings me to another accoutrement that this gorilla brings to the table when he's sitting in the middle of the room. And that was another component of Race to the Top. And that was the privileging of innovative, in quotes, alternative certification programs for teachers. So now when you've been able to, through the VAM models and through data mining and through the testing system, you've been able to get rid of a whole lot of veteran teachers and union teachers, and particularly teachers who've devoted their lives to working with children in low socioeconomic schools and neighborhoods. Then with Race to Top, you have this ability to replace them with novice Teach for America types who are again, non-union, may or may not stay in the system, so their salaries can stay low. And you have the ability to, for entrepreneurs to step in and develop other teacher prep programs and bypass traditional teacher education programs across the country. Now, that's some of the parts of Race to the Top that go along with this gorilla in the room, the Common Core State Standards. Now, let's put a hat on its head. So here you have this gorilla, all these things in his hands, and now you have the big old charter school hat poised on top of the Common Core gorilla's head. So one thing that we did, that Race to the Top did, was on top of all these other things, is to open up the doors for even more charter schools. So now you can fire teachers, you hold them accountable for test scores, and then when schools fail to make a progress, their test scores are low, you can close those schools, and you can open them up as charter schools, enabling entrepreneurs to make a whole lot of money, even if they're not for-profit, and so they're and operating as non-profit charter schools. There is a lot of money there as these entrepreneurs make sweet deals for their family and friends, make huge salaries. And guess what? If they don't live up to their promise and their test scores are as low as everybody else's, then they get to close them down, and then the kids are left scrambling to find another school. And that's not even to say the egregious nature of how charter schools are operated, because they operate under the mantra of choice systems in education. But in fact, what's happening is that the charter schools most often get to choose the kids who attend them. And low scores are kept out. Kids with special needs are kept out. And if a kid comes in and they have any kind of issue that might create a problem, whether it's test scores or behavior, they can kick them out and send them back to the public schools and thereby create this domino effect. So the public school then gets the kids that charter schools don't want. Their test scores go down lower. They get closed because of test scores. And then another charter school entrepreneur comes in, sweeps in, transitions the school to a charter school, and we start all over again. So that's the metaphor for the gorilla in the room, and I wanted to take a minute and explain that.
That is a very apt description, the gorilla, the 800-pound, 1,000-pound gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's made up of all of the components. Without those components being connected, like we connect dots, the gorilla really doesn't have that much impact. But it's when
right.
all of the components are connected that each of the components add to that 800-pound structure that the gorilla right. becomes the gorilla in the room.
And one other point, now over time, the gorilla is morphing, and it's becoming harder and harder to defeat because it's actually grown tentacles like an octopus. And so those of us who love public schools, who want to defeat this corporate takeover of public schools, we can lob off one tentacle. If there are eight, then we lob off one, there are seven left. You lob off two, there are five left. And so we are left with a daunting task, aren't we, James?
Well, basically, you hit the nail right on the head in terms of what this series is about and basically what the show is about in terms of coming to an awareness first and then an understanding of this is a war. It's not
yeah.
just an assault. Yeah. It's not a conflict. It's not a skirmish. It's an all-out war where the other side has as its objective, its end game, is the destruction of public education and the erection of privatized education at the public's expense. And in order to do so, it's taken them 35 consistent years up to this point, but the war that they started goes back a couple hundred years, as I have said to you and others, and we are at a point now where if you don't understand that it's a war, then you're not going to fight it properly, because you don't understand what it is you're fighting.
That's
until
right.
we
That's right.
reach that point of truly being aware and understanding, I don't even know whether or not we can lop off any of those tentacles that you just mentioned. And I got to be very careful when I say tentacles as opposed to testicles. So, sort of have me.
And that's why I like talking to you, James.
You see, I'd be lopping off testicles. And
No. We're not going
tentacles.
There. Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, no, my
all
friend.
Right. All right. That's why I said I have to be careful. And it's Easter Sunday and all that other stuff that I don't really have to deal with. But now, the point is, and you made it so eloquently, at least for me, is that have we had any success? And the point of the series, as I envision it, was to, for those resistors, the Common Core resistors, the opt-outers, and et cetera, is to provide more in-depth information that will hopefully increase one's awareness, but more importantly, increase one's understanding of the complexity of what we're up against. And
right.
The best way to
right.
do that is going back and getting a historical, big picture understanding of how it started, where it started, who was involved, and how we got to where we are today. Because
yes.
many people, and people will disagree and may even take homage to what I'm saying, they're fighting a losing war because they're not fighting it properly because they don't know who they're fighting and the strength of the fighting and that their tactics are like, I'll use the analogy in the movie Fury, if the recent movie with Brad Pitt. American soldiers in World War II had Sherman tanks. That's what the American tanks were called, the Sherman tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Germans, they learned from their defeat in World War I that they needed to build a bigger, stronger, faster tank. So when they came out with their tanks, their tanks were absolutely no match for American tanks. American tanks would fire their cannons. Those cannons would hit the surface of the Panzer tanks, and they would literally bounce off like tennis balls.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans, when they aimed and lined up and aimed, one shot would explode the Sherman tank. I compare our situation to that. When we are doing things that are about ineffective as a Sherman tank going up against a Panzer tank, energy, time, effort is being lost, wasted. What you're doing is providing us, those who want to better understand what we're doing and then what we have to do, you're giving us a damn good roadmap as to where this has all come from, better understanding of what the goals and objectives were back 30, 40 years ago, the players, and now, hopefully, people can go back, reassess their strategy, reassess their tactics, redirect their efforts to the more vulnerable weak spots in this attack, and hopefully become more effective. Now, I'm going to see if we can bring the caller back in one more time.
Okay.
Because what he can contribute goes right into what I just said. So, is the caller there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Hello? This is Joe.
I'm
and,
great. Can you hear me, man?
Yes, I can.
Yes.
And he
great.
Is...
Great. And so you've got the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say to people that your voice may sound muffled because it is. He wants to keep his identity secret because he is one of those millions of teachers who are in a vulnerable situation, and his identity should be kept secret at all costs, and this is the way in which we hope to do that. So with that, let's go directly to the report that you have and you sent us and tell us what you can about it. I have a question at the end as to why we're going through this with you. So take it from there.
Okay. we'll send you a report, and I had been reading about it in other booklets and said, what is this? And finally looked it up and found it. Essentially, looking in the report, one of the things they say is that warning about using funds to alleviate a non-existing crisis will harm education in the long run. That stands out at me, given the timeliness of the report, having been more than 20 years ago, and we have what we have today.
State that last point again. Using funds for a crisis that doesn't exist.
Yes, for a non-existing crisis, using funds to alleviate a non-existing crisis will harm education in the long run.
What happened? Was that the essence of the report?
That's one of the things I got from it. I got a few things as I looked through it. The improper use of simplistic data was a big one that stood out to me.
What else?
Yeah, and explain what happened, if you can, with the Sandia report, if you could.
Well, there are the claims that it was suppressed, and this is an interesting claim because everywhere I've looked, it says it was suppressed, yet I'm a big fan of Diane Ravitch, the one we know today. And on her website, she claims that it was not suppressed, but she does also claim, I'm looking at a response to a reader on the July 4th, 2013, where she said that report was right, she was wrong. And I think she's great. I like her today. I don't know, I mean, that's a while before my time, I suppose, but I wanted to see the report. The report apparently contradicts A Nation at Risk. And what I find interesting about the report is it cites data. It cites the National Center for Education Statistics. It cites SAT, not just SAT aggregate, but by subpopulations. And it comes up with different ideas.
Absolutely. Yes, actually, it really points to the greatness of our educational system in that we were making opportunities for people who had not previously had those opportunities in this country, and acknowledges that we have work to do, and we continue to do that work in an honorable way, but there is no crisis.
Indeed.
That's where I come in terms of the issue of whether or not the report was suppressed versus it was widely available. I fall on the side of that it was suppressed. Now, Diane can fall on her side and cite her evidence for that. I will cite mine in that I'm a professional. I'm an expert. I studied back in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. I was teaching and et cetera. It was not, in my view, widely available.
Let me add this. Gerald Bracey, the late great Gerald Bracey, did quite a bit of investigation into the Sandy report, and he spoke with Lee Bray, who headed up the Sandia project, and Lee Bray told him definitively it was buried, it was suppressed. And so I'm an admirer of Diane Ravitch as well, and I admire her work. I admire her tenacity. And, of course, I admire the movement that she spawned in recent years. And she has a different perspective, and we have to respect that. So whether she sees it as having been suppressed or not, I think is not necessarily the issue. I think the big thing is we can all say definitively, we didn't hear about it. So I too was teaching at the time, so I'm old enough to have been around. And it wasn't, it never hit. Listen, A Nation at Risk hit every newspaper headline. Sandy Report was buried in a little journal that, you know, only people interested in education research would even know where to look.
Now, the reason that I asked you to come on was that you did the due diligence in terms of trying to, one, get the report some time ago, and then getting us involved in terms of letting us know that you had a copy of it, you made that available, we both had a chance to look at it, et cetera. And I'm thanking you right here, right now, for what you have done. I have a question that makes everything that you have done and everything that we've said so far, I think, very salient. And that question, and I'll pose it to you as well, Deb, if the report had been widely disseminated, if it had been picked up by the newspapers at the time, TV news, educators from pre-K to PhD, legislators, would we have what we have today?
I think I would say definitively no.
Let me finish. Would we have had the path to No Child Left Behind? Would we have had the path open to Race to the Top? And going back before that, would we have the path open for a Milton Friedman to push his free market economy? Would we have had people like Reagan who said that government can't solve the problem because the government is a problem, leading to trickle-down economic insanity? Would we have the four tent poles that I mention all the time when I talk about neoliberalism, which was what Milton Friedman was pushing, and Ronald Reagan picked it up and went big time on it, so did Margaret Thatcher, and you people, you know where I'm going, Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and Yao Ming in China. Would we have had any of that, all of that, some of it, what have you? No Child Left Behind, I'm sorry, A Nation at Risk opened the door for all of what I just said to march through. Would Sandy have blocked that doorway?
I think if the Sandy report had been publicized at the same level as A Nation at Risk, I think it would have thrown the curtain open on Oz. And we would have seen the little man with the levers manipulating education policy, and a different discussion would have ensued. I think that scholars and teachers and anyone concerned about public education would have realized that they had been duped and lied to for a number of years in the name of Friedmanomic free market ideology a la Reagan. So I think a la Reagan's administration and the people who were promoting his education policies, the concept of school choice, vouchers, and charters would have died, because that was all the whole concept behind A Nation at Risk was this urge to destroy the reputation of our public schools in America, to create a crisis that told people we need to shut down this government monopoly on public education. And a Sandy report would have revealed this is chicanery at its best. They're just manipulating the country. It's propaganda. Our schools are doing well. We have work to do.
Can I just stop you for one second, and then you go right back? Chicanery means nothing. It was bullshit. Now continue.
Okay, bullshit. Okay, yes. And we would have picked it back up. I think we would have turned our back on all of the mockery of public education. We would have dispelled A Nation at Risk. It would have been put on a dusty shelf where it belonged. It would have been relegated to history. We would have gone about the business of further developing our public education system as the best education system in the world. I mean, it's absolute mockery. You can call it bullshit, but it was ridiculous what they did. And Sandy Report said, here, there are some weaknesses. There are some things we could work on. There are still some gaps. But we're making progress. So let's just keep going. Let's keep working on this American ideal of a public education. I mean, I'm always astounded because I go to conferences sometimes, and if I'm speaking with other professors that are from other countries, for example, I was presenting at a conference one time, and a professor from South America, one of the South American countries, was there, and I was talking about some issues, and she said to me, "I wish I had your problem." And I looked at her and I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because in my country, kids aren't required to go to school, and most of the time I can't get them to come back if they need to work in the market with their parents." And it just brought it all home to me. And people, and our, oh, this is, I can't believe that they get away with this by talking about how our schools don't measure up with international countries. It's just absolutely bizarre to me. So the Sandy report, if it had been publicized, I think would have changed the entire trajectory of our conversations about public schools. You would not have your radio show. I would not have written my book. I think we might have been able to engage on other levels about the greatness of our schools and solving some of the problems that we've been distracted from solving. We still have huge problems, and the current education reform system has not helped to truly close the gender and the education gaps in our country. We still have problems with race. We still have problems with identity. We still have problems with poverty, huge problems with poverty. We can't even talk about those because of this particular movement when it started. This aspect of the movement post-Sandy report, we can pick it up with the Clinton administration, and we developed this mantra of no excuses in public schools. Poverty is not an excuse. Not being able to speak English, not an excuse.
Let me come in. We just lost our caller. He said his app that he was using to disguise his voice just timed out. So I want to thank him for his courage.
Yes.
And making all the extra steps that he needed to protect himself in order to be able to get on air for the short time that he was here. Let me close by just saying this. I believe further that if the Sandy report had gotten out, then the reports that were studies that were done afterwards, and I've said this many times about my discipline in sociology, the Coleman report, and other reports that said it's inequality, that's the issue. It's the not the achievement gap, it's the opportunity gap. And what we need to do is what you just labored on, deal with inequality. We need a Marshall Plan, which I have argued for years, to deal with our educational issue. What Johnson and his quote, "The Great Society" was supposed to do. The enemy was poverty. We solve poverty, we solve a lot of America's social issues.
Amen.
Because Sandy was buried and a nation at risk was still there visible, we never got an opportunity for politicians like a Johnson and who would come after him to push dealing with the opportunity gap and see what happens to the education gap. Now, let's go back to where you wanted to go today. Pick up where we left off last week, and let's see how far we can get on getting through the book with the time that's left today.
Okay. All right. So if I may, I'll just pick it up with this. The eras of Bush 1 through Bill Clinton's era is the era in which we ushered into our education policy arena the corporate superstar. Corporate superstars, let me go back just a second. 1987, there was a quote I think that speaks a lot to what started to happen with Bush 1 and it was sort of the aura within our country. And that is, if you remember the movie Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, 1987, he says, "Greed is good." And that's
greed is good.
Greed is good. And we all loved that. I mean, I thought, wow, we all stood up a little taller and we said, yeah, greed, money rules the world. And at the same time, you have people out there like David Kearns, who was later appointed to the Bush 1 Department of Education. He was the CEO of Xerox. He is credited with turning around Xerox, and that became the mark of a great man in our country, a wise, benevolent man, a man who could turn around a huge industry like Xerox. And then we have Lou Gerstner. He did the same thing with IBM. And then now it's no surprise we have Gates. He's sort of like the younger brother or the offspring of these two guys. We're just enamored with people who have the ability to make huge amounts of money. And then we started to do this thing where we started to listen to them on all aspects. Like, just because you could run a company like IBM, which is a great thing, but does that really make you an expert in education policy or social issues at all? As a matter of fact, I imagine people who worked in those businesses when they were turning them around and firing them, I bet they would say, no, I wouldn't let them near anything as large as public education policy. So, here comes Bill Clinton, and he really just sort of picks up education policy from George I. As a matter of fact, America 2000, when he was a governor in 89 for the Bush 1 administration, and when Bush did not win a second term, Bill Clinton, who felt like he owned America 2000, basically tweaked it, morphed it, added a couple more teeth to it, and it became Gold 2000, and passed it in Congress. And it's no surprise that at this time, the Business Roundtable is their big push to influence education policy. They were everywhere. I don't know, some of you may remember back in the early 90s, you would even go to McDonald's and it would have like test prep questions on it, like little maps and things and questions that you can answer. I remember taking my kids there and going, wow, that's kind of cool. And then later I realized, oh, wait, the Business Roundtable is funding this to push their policy agenda for education. So when, much like Barack Obama did in picking Arne Duncan because he was friendly with the business community, Bill Clinton picked Richard Riley, former governor of South Carolina. And historian Jesse Rhodes quotes Riley as saying to the business community, our agenda is your agenda. And so he's privileging the Business Roundtable. I do want to give a shout-out to Kathy Emery and Susan Ohanian back early on were writing about this issue. Their book, Why is Corporate America Bashing Education, is an excellent read if you want to know more about the Business Roundtable. They really dissect all of their efforts.
That was one of the first.
In a very expressive manner.
That was one of the first. That was one of the first super well documented arguments trying to bring the American public to an awareness of why are we being villainized by the Business Roundtable or corporate America.
Right, and that's why I was so honored when Susan Ohanian reviewed my book, and so her review is on the back of my book, because she was there working diligently alongside Gerald Bracey and others that were actually, they never got the respect that they were owed, I think, for their efforts in making America aware of what was going on with corporate America.
I want to get her on the show, by the way.
Well, I will try to get her. Yeah, I only know her because I was just a humble little literacy professor, and I had been reading her blog. She was one of the first bloggers. I had been reading her blog for years, and I thought, I wonder if she would. And I emailed her, and she said, sure, right away. So she's a wonderful, good soul for doing that. I will always be indebted to her.
Well, good. You give me encouragement. Okay. Major takeaway from what you just said is, for me, people don't get it about Bill Clinton's role in the development of the corporate war on public education. Mm-hmm. He played a huge role. That smiling centrist was his cover when he should have been saying, I am a corporate entity, and I am going to bring every ounce of my influence to corporatizing America and get used to it. But he didn't say it, of course.
No, he didn't. As a matter of fact, I'm with you. I was always an admirer of Clinton. I went through all of the scandals and everything thinking, God, he's great. I even spoke at the Clinton Center one time when I was in Arkansas. It was only through writing and researching and writing the book that I realized, much to my chagrin, I have to say, that it's kind of ground zero, his administration. And where, if you build theory about how this happened, the theoretical roots, the historical roots with the conservatives, the theoretical roots are with the Clinton administration and his third way of governance.
So let me say this, and then we're going to go right into the third way. Back just before the 2014 elections, I think it was Politico, they had an article that said that if Democrats were to run on an education platform, they would win. I talked about it. Democrats didn't do it. They got their asses kicked. Mm-hmm. Now, an article came out last week or so, and it said basically Hillary is between a rock and a hard place. That is, Hillary, when she first ran, she had the support of teachers union, and she was out there pumping her fist for go teachers. Now the question becomes, will she follow in the footsteps of her husband, the corporate Democrat, the footsteps of Obama, super corporate Democrat? Will she come out as a corporate Democrat, pushing charter schools, pushing the corporate takeover of public education, or will she stand up on behalf of the lowly teachers and their unions like she did before? I have said one of the things that I'm trying to do is make education a national issue that it is and should be, but make it such an issue that all politicians in both 2016 and 2020 are going to have to deal with it, from the dog catcher to the president, which there's no real difference between it, is there? But anyway, they're going to have to deal with that. And Governors, senators, congressmen, you name it. Hillary Clinton, I believe, is a corporate Democrat. I mean, to me, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that she's a corporate Democrat. She's not a populist. She's not a progressive. So that what you're talking about today is going to come back and bite people in the ass just a few months from now and a few years down the line. That's another one of the beauties of your book. When I named the title of the shows that we're doing, Common Core Today, Back to the Future. This is what I'm talking about,
right.
Back to the Future. All this stuff mm-hmm. that is happening today had its antecedents back 30, as you tried to do, show back 80 years ago, really, and I take it back to the Continental Congress, so I go way back with it. But this is, to me, and I'm saying this to all the listeners, this is what this show lives for, is try and create that awareness, create the understanding, illuminate the dots out there, because they're there, so that you can see them, and then start trying to arrange them in such a way that you get both the macro picture, the large picture, as well as the micro picture. And my favorite thing is what Edmund Burke said, and I said it last week, and I say it almost every week, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, third way. Go take us into the third way.
Okay. Well, the third way has its origins, and Diane Ravitch points this out in her book, with Bill Clinton. A book came out that basically laid out the blueprint for the third way, and the book was called Reinventing Government, How the Entrepreneurial Spirit is Transforming the Public Sector from the Schoolhouse to the State House, City Hall, to the Pentagon. And basically, the idea is that in order to make policy, you bring together the disparate groups. You bring together Republicans, you bring together Democrats. But the most potent power is that it opened the door for the corporate world to get a major seat at the table of policymaking. And so this was across all sectors, all the public sectors in government. But I think through my lens, I'm examining education policy. This was very profound. A great example, an illustration of how this works is the Palisades Conference in 1996. Palisades Conference is where ACHIEVE was born. ACHIEVE brought us what? The Common Core State Standards. And so who led this effort but one of our corporate superstars, Lou Gerstner, formerly of IBM. He appeared as a special guest at the 1995 National Governors Association, and he ironically stated this: "I'm here because of Willie Sutton. Willie robbed banks, the story goes, because he realized that's where the money is. I'm here because this is where the power is, the power to reform, no, to revolutionize the U.S. public school system." He goes on in his speech later to say he's angry because the governors haven't sufficiently reformed public schools in the few years since the 1989 Governors Association meeting. And he challenges them, and he says, the only way it will happen, the transformation of American public schools, the only way that we even have a ghost of a chance of getting there is if we push through a fundamental, bone-jarring, full-fledged, 100% revolution that discards the old and replaces it with a totally new performance-driven system. Performance-driven system testing.
Stop, because I'm having all kinds of laughter over here. I've been saying this. This is what, again, the War Report's about. To make people understand that there has been this thing that I call the Machiavellian agenda. And the bottom line of that agenda is what you just said. The destruction of public education and the erection of a new system that will be privatized on the American dime. That's everything that we've done on a year plus is what you just said, and you show the historical nature of this in that one little sentence. Thank you. Proceed.
Let's go on to the Palisades Conference, because IBM headquarters at Palisades hosted the governors to come together, and each of them were charged with bringing what? A corporate CEO. So now we have governor, corporate CEO from every state, and they're going to set the agenda for American education policy in 1996. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do find this quite interesting. Wisconsin's governor, Tommy Thompson, who was helping to plan the Palisades Conference, made a telling statement, a very interesting statement, when he was talking about what they were going to do. Tommy Thompson said, he explained that if the state governors were involved in education policy, then, and I'm going to paraphrase this part, he said the standards would be set up by communities and states, not by the federal government. What I think he meant, this is my paraphrase part, was we can create the illusion that the standards are being made set by communities and states. And then he went on to say, this will spark a race to the top. That's each community
and
eventually
each state. Does that sound
familiar?
Does that sound familiar? Race from the top. When was that set? Back in, wasn't
19?
Yesterday?
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but you know what? I see the evidence there that somebody was reading a little bit about Palisades when they named this huge initiative called What Race to the Top? Yes. And so what they did at Palisades, they set an agenda. It was pretty, talk about Machiavellian. They suggested, for example, that within a year, businesses participating in the summit would require the job applicants to demonstrate academic achievement through transcripts, diplomas, portfolios. Within a year, an external independent non-governmental group will be in place to provide public leadership, a national clearinghouse, national international benchmarking, technical assistance, ... That would be what achieve. With three, within 2 years, governors would establish internationally competitive academic standards and assessments to measure academic achievement and accountability systems within individual states. And four, businesses participating in the summit will place high priority on the quality of a state's academic standards and student achievement when determining business location decisions. And there you have it. So that was achieved. That's 1996. Achieve was formed. They had their marching orders. They go on to proceed. In the meantime, now this is where the third way of governance is actually truly empowered in a way that Mike Lofgren, who was a government official for almost 30 years, I saw him on the Bill Moyer show, and he was actually talking about other governmental entities like NSA and other aspects of public policy. But Mike Lofgren describes what he calls the deep state of policymaking of governance. And this is kind of chilling when you think about what he's talking about. Mike Lofgren describes the deep state this way. He said, the deep state occurs when Wall Street CEOs become key players in government policymaking. And he goes on to say that... there is another government. Before I read this, here's what we need to know. I want the American public to know. The Common Core State Standards did not originate in 2009. The Common Core State Standards, the process for creating them began in 2001. 2001, ACHIEVE developed the American Diploma Project. And in their own documents, if you read the American Diploma Projects, they actually are referred to as the Common Core. And so part of what we see in the Common Core today actually has a longer history than we give it credit for. So that was ACHIEVE's earlier efforts in creating the Common Core. So literally while the nation was trying to come to grips with No Child Left Behind, 2001-2002, there was an alternate world of policymaking going on. This is the world that, as Mike Lofgren asserts, there is another government. Another government concealed behind the one that is visible on either end of the Pennsylvania Avenue, a hybrid entity of public and private institutions across the country. ... Page 143 in the book. So
okay,
understand
now,
that. Okay.
We have to go. We're just getting underneath the surface here. We plan to do three shows on this, and that's what it's going to take. However, the third show will not come next week. Instead, we are going to deal with the Atlanta convictions that took place Friday. We're doing a special on that. Deb may be with me on that as well, since she's irate as well. And then we'll come back with Deb, and then we'll finish off with hopefully inviting some of the people from the various resistance group dealing with the Common Core and the resistance group dealing with opt-out to finish off, and then people from Fair Test and people from Defend Ed. With that, folks, this is a big topic. Couldn't cover it in one show, two shows, and now you see I'm going over, and I'm going to have to say thank you for being with us, and please come back next week because the Atlanta thing is the hottest thing going right now. Happy holidays to everyone. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.